Hey, this is John Lee Dumas of the award-winning podcast, Entrepreneurs on Fire, and you're listening to the Excelsior Journeys with George Soroy. Prepare to ignite.
So would you say that that's kind of like the lightning bolt moment for
you? And that's
why
I taught myself how to draw, was actually the Little Mermaid, drawing stills of Ariel.
I've got better things to do tonight than die.
Sylvester jumped out of his chair and said, who the F is this?
I remember walking out of the theater with him saying, I'm going to write Halloween.
I'm rather impressed with your research. Rarely do people ask me about Children in the Corn.
It doesn't have to be perfect. Just do it. You know, throw some spaghetti against a wall. See if it sticks.
This is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward. Welcome back to episode 15 of season 2 of Excelsior Journeys Behind the Scenes, part of the National Podcast Post-Month Challenge. This is George Soroy, and thank you so much for being here. And I hope that you have been listening to all of the different shows that have taken part in this challenge. The challenge is simple. By the end of November 30th, if you have successfully completed the challenge, then you have recorded, edited, and posted a podcast every day for 30 days. In my case, I'm playing a lot of catch up, but I'm still committed to completing this challenge and expect to have the final episodes of this show submitted before the end of the day on November 30th. So I'm really excited about this, and I hope you are too. This has been a really good eye-opening look back at all the different writing that I've done and all that has to do with like stage and either the big or small screen. A lot of these projects never really amounted to anything, and some of them wound up morphing into other things. I'll get into those in future episodes. In fact, there's one in particular that I'm really excited about that I get to delve into in just a couple of episodes. But before that, I wanted to tell a little bit about the times that I flirted with fan fiction. And when I say fan fiction, it's basically just, for those of you who are not familiar with the phrase, it's basically just taking familiar characters, familiar IPs, familiar settings, and creating original scenarios about them and seeing what your take would be. Now, there are a few things that I've done. One of them, I kind of knew, like it was a long shot that no one would be knocking down my doors to see what I would do with this particular property, with any of the three particular properties. But what I did was back in 97, summer of 97, that was when I, like so many other people, although not as many as there were in the past, but a good amount, wound up seeing Batman and Robin. This was the fourth Batman film in this franchise, the second one directed by Joel Schumacher. This is the one with the cast list that includes Arnold Schwarzenegger, George Clooney, Chris O'Donnell, Uma Thurman, and Alicia Silverstone, including Michael Goff returning as Alfred and Pat Hingle returning as Commissioner Gordon. And Elizabeth. And since Batman Forever in 1995 was such a big success, Warner Brothers decided that they were going to push everything toward a more kiddified approach, something that more reflected the 1966 show rather than the 1989 and 1992 Tim Burton films. It was going to go in a completely different direction than originally intended. As a result, we got something that has been labeled as one of the worst comic book adaptations on the big screen. It is one that was responsible for a lot of people looking at this genre as something that shouldn't be explored for a while. And it actually put Batman on ice, so to speak, you know, no pun intended, since this one includes Mr. Freeze, for about 8 years before he made his triumphant return in 2005 with Batman Begins and the start of the Christopher Nolan Dark Knight trilogy. There was a lot going on, you know, like with this character, and a lot of it had to do with this film, with all the decisions that were made, from the casting to the script to the executives declaring what was going to go into effect and what would not. A whole lot of that led to this almost universally panned film. And while I was watching it, I just remember being so confused as to how something that was so powerful with the 1989 film be reduced to this. And I was kind of hoping that after reading the adaptation, I was kind of hoping that after reading the novelization, there was hope that there was something that was going to be an enjoyable experience. I remember reading the novelization and being charmed by it. I was like, okay, I think I get what they're going with this. But the execution on the screen just was not there. I wasn't counting on a bat credit card making an appearance, so to speak. So it was definitely not what I was looking for in a Batman film. And the more I got to see it, the more it felt like, okay, this is definitely not for me. I get what they were doing there because each of the different films plays to different eras of Batman. And that's really the thrill of the DC heroes as opposed to the Marvel heroes. Marvel heroes are pretty much like set in a certain way. You really can't stray too far from them or else they'll not be who they are. But all the characters that we see in DC, they're all very malleable. They can make all different appearances and types of changes, especially Batman. Eventually, he just winds up snapping right back into the character that he always was. And that was something they were really exploring in these four films. And so this was definitely the era of the 1950s and 60s comic book and the 1966 TV show. And I just remember watching it just thinking like, what could I have done that would improve upon this? Obviously not rewrite the film because the film is out there and there's nothing you can do to change that. However, there was talk for months afterwards on the internet about a potential fifth film called Batman Triumphant. It was going to feature the Scarecrow as the main villain. There was talk with approaching Howard Stern to play the Scarecrow just because of his size and look, which was definitely not going to work. Thankfully, that never happened. I just remember thinking, what would I do differently for this? While I was a senior in college, I started writing a treatment. It came out not bad, actually. Basically, what I did was I decided that I was going to follow their lead and go with the Scarecrow as the main villain. I was also going to incorporate Harley Quinn and also the B-level villain, Cornelius Sturck, who is also someone who preys on fear. And he's someone who basically just morphs into other characters. Basically just like he can, you know, give this illusion that he is someone else and use that as a method of fear against someone else. And so that was something that I wanted to play with. So I basically had Scarecrow being released from Arkham Asylum and going back to his old job as a professor at Gotham University. He was creating a specific type of hypnosis device to enslave all of the students at his class and have them become his minions. And those minions that he would send out to start an attack on Arkham Asylum and therefore do what Bane did in Nightfall, which is attack the asylum, break it open, and let all of this chaos run rampant over Gotham City. That was the plan I had in mind. And there were a lot of different things that I was using as inspiration. In the second half of Nightfall, after Batman's back is broken, Jean-Paul Valley takes over as Batman. There's a small miniseries in the Shadow of the Bat comic about Scarecrow enslaving a bunch of students and instructing one of them to kill another one with a gun. It's definitely a much darker approach with this, but at the same time, it was something that I felt was needed and kind of bring Batman kind of back to its roots. And if they were going to do one more in this franchise, I felt it best to really right that ship and send it off on the right note. I had Scarecrow doing this. I had Cornelius Sturck as his main henchman, and Cornelius Sturck freaking out Robin to the point where he was doubting his own abilities. Later on in the story, he winds up almost killing Robin. And that's what leads up to a moment that was very famous in the comics when the Joker shoots Robin and he stays alive and everything. Batman is getting Robin out of the building, getting him into the Batmobile. And Commissioner Gordon is saying, "Did Robin die tonight?" And Batman says, "For all intents and purposes, yes." And he decides that he was not going to put any kid in any danger anymore. And that's when Dick Grayson decided to walk away from him and become his own man and become Nightwing. And so I wanted to play that up as well. So that element is there. But at the same time, there's another element, and that's Harley Quinn. Harley is someone in my story who is in the same circus as Dick Grayson and the Flying Graysons. She was the main headliner for the clowns. She was someone who was a big draw. She was a kid. She was like about at that point, she was very much the center of attention with the clowns, getting all the other clowns to try to chase after her and everything. And she would use her acrobatic abilities to get out of the way and become a whole lot of, funny moments. So we get to see that at the very beginning of the story. And right after we see the circus come to a close, she is in her dressing room and she goes over to this cutout picture of the Joker, the Jack Nicholson version, and gives him a kiss and is really just kind of playing up the fact that she is in love with him and she will eventually be with him. Meanwhile, he has no idea who he is. He's doing his own thing in Gotham City. The other clowns are making fun of her, saying, I guess you're going to be his gun mole, huh? She walks out of the room. She is outside. She's got her makeup off and everything. And she starts overhearing different people chattering about what just happened in Gotham City. What just happened was the 200th anniversary celebration that the Joker crashes with his own balloons and the Smilex gas, which eventually leads to the Joker plummeting to his death at the top of Gotham City Cathedral. So at the end of this whole scene, everyone is kind of like talking about, because this is over in Metropolis at this point, and everyone is saying how it looks like they finally got the Joker. She overhears this and sees the news that the Joker is killed. She completely snaps and loses it and everything. And whatever makeup was still on her face just runs off from the rain that's coming down. And that's where we are with that. That's where that part ends. And then it moves forward about 10 years or so. And it was a lot of fun putting this whole thing together, especially when we get to see Harley and she is just an absolute mess. She decides that she is going to, in a combination of Michelle Pfeiffer's transformation from Selina Kyle to Catwoman and Eric Draven's transformation into the Crow when he puts on the makeup and everything and becomes that character. That's exactly what Harley winds up doing. She just snaps and gets herself in full clown regalia because she is going to take her revenge against Batman for taking away the man that she loves. So the three of them wind up teaming up together, Harley, Cornelius, and the Scarecrow. At one point, Cornelius winds up getting taken out and almost kills Robin. It leads to a scene that is similar to a combination of Clarice and Hannibal in The Silence of the Lambs and Billy Baldwin's character, Brian McCaffrey, and Donald Sutherland's character. I think it was Harold. I think that was what his name was, or Ronald. But he was in Backdraft when he's saying, like, did the fire look at you? And winds up kind of giving him the last bit of information about who is starting those fires. This is Cornelius basically just messing with Batman and having him basically just realize what's happening, what is Scarecrow's ultimate plan. And so that's what we wind up seeing here. And so like that leads into the third act climax. So the whole thing, it was a really fun exercise. And not only did I get to knock out that whole treatment while I was in school, but afterwards, around September of 1998, after I had graduated from college, I decided to hell with it. I'm going to start writing this. On day one, I knocked out about 10 pages. And then the next day, I started knocking out a couple more pages and then just kept on chipping away at it. And about 5 weeks later, I had a completed screenplay and it was pretty damn good. I decided it was going to be a really good exercise and I was going to leave it at that. I didn't really know what to do with it. And eventually I wound up putting it online and I'll include the link for it so you can take a look at it. But I hope you like it. I hope it winds up being a good read for you. Just keep in mind that this was done before all the, you know, everything regarding Batman Begins, The Dark Knight Rises, all of that. It's before we got that sort of sensibility of Batman and how realistic comic book movies can get. I decided that if George Clooney was going to continue on, then this would be a good way to redeem him, because he definitely got a tough break when it came to him being Batman. I think he would have done a better job with a better script. It's one of those things where you have to just accept it and then also be thankful for it, because without Batman and Robin being what it was, you don't get the Christopher Nolan movies. You don't get that need to take that hard turn and actually get it back to where it was. This was my salute to those Batman movies. I always loved them, always wanted to see them succeed. So with that in mind, that wound up being the first piece of fan fiction that I would go on to write. In August of 98, that's when we got Halloween H2O 20 years later. And what looked like the final struggle between Laurie Strode and Michael Myers. Obviously, you know, we would get that final struggle a couple more times. And one of those times was something that I found out online was in the works. And that would eventually be Halloween Resurrection. And that was something that I was very much against. And then when I saw the movie itself, I realized I was right. I couldn't stand that movie. But before the movie came out, I was hearing all the different approaches on how it would go and how, you know, like what sort of direction this next part would go in. And they knew that because H2O was such a big hit, they just didn't know exactly what they were going to do with it. So I decided, why not put together a little treatment just to see what I can do? I continued right where we left off, and I used a little bit of what Halloween Resurrection would eventually use, because there was a lot of speculation about how Michael was able to get away from that whole incident, from getting crushed between the tree and the van, and then eventually getting his head chopped off. How is he going to be able to come back from that? And the only way that could have happened is what is proposed in Halloween Resurrection. He wakes up, switches spots with a paramedic, and then the paramedic winds up being the one to get his head chopped off. Instead of letting Laurie just go nuts and be in an asylum, my story has the real Michael Myers tracking her down, following her the whole time, and then killing her. It's not a great way for a character of Laurie's stature to end, but at the same time, it wasn't a great way for her to end in Halloween Resurrection as well. So for this, I just made it very quick. But at the same time, Michael is now hearing voices. And the voices are telling him to come home. And what it means is to come home to Haddonfield. So he has to go from Summer Glen, California, back over to Haddonfield, Illinois. The reason why is because there is basically talk about the plan that winds up being an amalgam of, like, tying up a lot of different threads. So it ties up the loose threads of Halloween 6, The Curse of Michael Myers. It continues on from H2O and also brings in Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. The main adversary in this is Cochran, the son of Connell Cochran. He has tracked down, romanced, and intends to wed the daughter of Dan Challis, Tom Atkins' character from Halloween 3. His plan is to assist Michael with tying up the loose ends of killing off his own bloodline, and in this case, winds up tracking down Stephen, the son of Jamie Lloyd, who is now with a different family. The father of that family is an investigative reporter who is doing this whole expose on Michael Myers, so that's why they're in Haddonfield, to do research. Stephen is with them and can sense there's a lot of evil. The family is trying to keep him safe from getting attacked by Michael Myers, and therefore, once the curse is completed, once the whole bloodline is wiped out, the curse of Thorn will be passed on to someone else. This guy intends for the child of Cochran and Challis to have this curse and continue killing off the Chalice bloodline, creating the ultimate revenge for Connell Cochran's plan to be foiled. It's convoluted as hell. I will be the first to admit that. But it was fun to write. It was definitely a lot of fun to write. I called it Halloween Millennium and then put it as a tagline, Terror Stands the Test of Time. It wound up being a fun exercise. And I even sent in a query letter to Trankus International just to see what happens. Didn't expect to hear back from him, and I didn't. That was my second foray into fan fiction. I never actually wound up writing that script. The third foray into fan fiction was one that just happened a few years ago. And that was when I tried my hand on something that I still consider to this day a big goal of mine. Everyone's got their own pie-in-the-sky goals. This one is mine. I want to be able to say that I wrote a Transformers sequel. I wanted to pick up the threads from the end of The Last Knight and use that as a launching pad for one big trilogy. And it would basically be my own Days of Future Past. It would bring the Optimus Prime from this universe, from the Michael Bay movies, the five movies, and bring him into the universe that would eventually be Bumblebee and Rise of the Beasts. It would basically see like what, you know, like what would wind up launching that. Now, I don't want to go into too many details on this because this was one that I brought to the attention of my agent. My agent gave me instructions on how to move forward. I have a treatment put together, a very basic outline, as well as one major scene that incorporates a lot of different answers about what is going on with this. And I also brought in Skywarp and Thundercracker and a lot of the classics that we all grew up with. I think there's something there that works. And it could wind up being successful. I'm proud of it, the storyline and everything and how it's coming together. But I also know my own stature as a writer. And I'm not there yet in terms of what is expected of me. You know, definitely not a name at this point yet. It's something that I still want to hold on to. I still want to keep those cards really close to my chest. And also, just to see that if it winds up not happening, that's a high probability, but I always like to consider the possibilities. But if there's a chance that that can happen, fantastic. But if not, maybe it could be like a movie tie-in novel that would be based on that universe, but it would be its own original story. That would be great to be able to do that, but I don't know. But those were my first, those were so far my only forays into fan fiction. So I have a completed script with Batman Triumphant, and I'll put the link on the show notes here. I have an outline for Halloween Millennium, which is definitely not going to see the light of day. And then the third one is my Transformers story called Transformers Redemption. I still hold out hope for that one, so I'm not going to go into too many details on it because you never know. You never know what might happen. But if there's a chance of me getting in a room with Lorenzo de Bonaventura and sharing one single question that I hope will get his attention, then who knows? I hope that you guys have been enjoying this look back through my writing, and there's still a lot more stories to tell. And one in particular that's coming up is quite the epic that would eventually become, as I can say now, the upcoming trilogy of books from Ronan Weatherford Publishing called From Parts Unknown. That one has its own saga to it, and I'm excited to delve into that. I'm really psyched for the stories that are coming, and I hope you'll enjoy hearing them as well. I'll be going into the next episode. I'm actually going to be going into my writing for television class, and that was heaven. It was great to be in a class like that. So I am really psyched for what's going to come next. Until then, this is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Excelsior Journeys. I hope it was both inspiring and entertaining. Special thanks to Zach Comtois for providing new music for the intro and outro. Please take a moment to leave a rate and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you enjoy the show, please share it with your friends and subscribe to your platform of choice by going to hesgotit.com/podcasts. While there, you can also fill out the application to be a guest. inquire about sponsorship opportunities, and click on the Buy Me a Coffee link if you wish to give your support to the show. All interaction is very much appreciated. If you have a question, comment, or suggestion for the show, please direct it to George@hesgotit.com.